House Committee on Judiciary come to order is Wednesday, February 25th, 2015. Possible introductions of committee measures.
Chair Barker, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 424, dated 2-24-15. LC 232, 3. dated 2-25-15. LC 2884, dated 1-5-15. LC 2895, dated 2-12-15. LC 2995, dated 2-19-15. LC 3349, dated 2-20-15.
Representative Remington moves to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2337.
Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2327 comes to us at the request of the Judicial Department. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We do have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill. We don't have any amendments before us today. So population growth, along with a sizable increase in civil case filings in Marion, Multnomah, and Washington counties, presents a need for more circuit court judges in the 3rd, 4th, and 20th judicial districts. House Bill 2327 adds one judge to each of these counties who will assume duty on the first Monday of January in 2017.
Just Chief Justice Ballmer, please.
I'm Tom Ballmer, for the record, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. And Chair Barker, thank you for scheduling this bill. As committee staff stated, this would add one statutory judicial position each in Multnomah, Marion, and Washington counties. We have needs in many counties, frankly, for additional judicial officers, but I selected these three because of the persistent need for new judges in these judicial districts. The legislature has not added new judicial positions anywhere in the state for the last 10 years. The last time that new judges were added was in the 2005-2007 biennium, and none of these three counties have had any new judges despite the increased population and case filings since 2001-2003, since that biennium. I have with me presiding judges from each of these judicial districts who will briefly talk about what the lack of judicial resources means for their courts. And our interest, frankly, in asking for these new judicial positions is to ensure that we can fulfill the state's constitutional responsibility to administer justice completely and without delay, which for those who are checking is Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution. The judicial branch is continuing its efforts to make sure that we're using every dollar wisely and adding additional judicial resources only when we absolutely need to. I mentioned some of these items when I spoke to this committee earlier, and I'm not going to review those, but we are using pro tem and retired judges to fill the gaps where we can. We're using technology such as video hearings to schedule judges more efficiently and reduce the need for additional judges in particular locations. We've centralized the number of cases, such as our post-conviction cases in Salem, where we use video and retired judges to handle those without adding additional judges. I'm working in Oregon and on a national commission to make sure that we're effectively managing our caseload. And this is really part of our Court Reengineering and Efficiencies Work Group, the CREW, which has been working towards efficiencies. What can we do with existing resources for the past 5 or 6 years? And finally, we're working with our new e-court system to see what other opportunities there are for efficiencies, other than the obvious ones of not having to locate files or making sure that the paperwork is in the case file, which is already for those courts that are on e-court, just a tremendous benefit. So with that, Chair Barker, I'd like to introduce Jamise Rhodes, who's the presiding judge here in Marion County, Judge Nan Waller, the presiding judge of Multnomah County, and Kirsten Thompson, the former presiding judge in Washington County. With your permission, Mr. Chair, they'll briefly talk about their individual courts and the need for these positions.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you very much.
You can go in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay.
Chair Barker and committee members, my name is Jamise Rhodes. I'm the presiding judge for Marion County Circuit Court. I've been a judge since 1990 and the presiding judge in Marion County since 2008, and I'm here to support the Oregon Judicial Department's request for new judgeships. I know you've received materials previously, but if you're anything like some of us, it's helpful to have us highlight that which you've already received and perhaps reviewed in depth, but maybe haven't had time to do it quite in depth. There is certainly statistical information, as the chief indicated, to support that our counties have become more populated and we are struggling to meet the timely disposition standards. In Marion County, we run three master calendars, which actually translates to five, because there's two judicial officers in two of those and then one judicial officer in the other. So we have five judicial officers presiding over master calendars that handle our criminal court annex, our juvenile court. We run two courts in each of those locations, and we have a civil calendar downtown where we have approximately 550 hearings per month. And I made a mistake in my statistics. That judicial officer reviews 450 ex parte orders and judgments that are submitted for review every week, not every month, as I mistakenly put in. We currently have a need for about 2.5 judicial positions, but the addition of even one is going to help us meet our deadlines. We also care about the quality of the services that we provide. Obviously, Marion County, much like Washington and Multnomah, has a number of different treatment courts. One of the things about treatment courts is, as you've probably heard before, they are very successful, but they're time-consuming, and they serve a smaller proportion of or portion of the community. So collectively, right now, based on our six treatment courts, adult and juvenile drug courts, two child welfare dependency courts, an adult mental health court, and veterans court, we collectively have about half of a judge managing those cases. And what that means is all of the other judges, the workload for the day-to-day processing of cases shifts to them. In fact, our mental health court judge is here to talk to you or observe for your next hearing. So we have grant funding for portions of those treatment courts, but it doesn't cover the judge's time. And we know it's well worth it, but it isn't sustainable to keep providing judicial resources without additional judicial resources to the court. Something that that as I reviewed my materials that I would like to add that kind of piggybacks a little bit on Washington Multnomah, because we don't all recreate the wheel every day. We try to learn from each other. Marion County has utilized some short-term stopgap measures to reduce delays. We have an early disposition program for our criminal cases. We have free mediation for our small claims and landlord-tenant disputes. We have family law facilitators to assist domestic relations self-represented litigants, because, as you know, those are becoming more and more prevalent. I think Ms. Judge Waller has actually listed the percentages in Multnomah County. They also assist our complainants in processing family abuse restraining orders. We have referees and pro tem judges to assist in processing juvenile, criminal, support enforcement, mental commitments, small claims, residential evictions, truancies, probate matters, and self-represented custody matters. We've worked with our district attorney's office to identify appropriate candidates for Marion County Senate Bill 416. I still refer to it. It's probably got some other name to it now. Their project goal to develop and implement evidence-based strategies to improve the supervision of probationers and reduce recidivism. We've had that program in effect since 2012. And our judges, we don't have a mandated or a specific judge that does judicially hosted settlement conferences, but our judges regularly conduct those settlement conferences to facilitate early and less expensive resolution of domestic, civil, and criminal cases. And just as an example, personally, two full days this week I've done settlement conferences, which I, based on what happened, it saved about 8 days of judicial trial time, and I'm going to have 2.5 days next week of, in addition to my regular workload, 2.5 days of judicially hosted settlement conferences, which I think ends up helping the litigants resolve their cases in a way that is more advantageous and less, particularly in domestic relations, less hateful to their soon-to-be former partner. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. Chair Barker, if there's any questions, or if maybe everybody wants to wait.
Okay. If there's any questions, Judge Waller, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. Multnomah County is a large urban center, and with that are both opportunities and challenges. As a large urban center with a large portion of the bar in the metro area, we have more complex cases probably filed in Multnomah County than other courts. Complex cases require a great deal of judicial attention to make sure that they are handled appropriately, timely, and seen through to the finish. On the flip side of being a large urban center, we are a draw because of the large services that are available through the efforts of local government to vulnerable populations, the homeless, those with mental illness, those with substance abuse issues. And so we've put a great deal of time and effort to make sure that we have, and often those are populations, given their vulnerabilities, that will come in contact with the judicial system. As a result, we've really looked to ways to better meet the needs of those vulnerable populations by coming up with treatment courts, community court. We have a multitude of treatment courts, mental health, drug treatment courts, intensive alcohol treatment courts. And as Judge Rhodes said, those are all courts that the results are good, but they are more time intensive. We have a growing diverse population, which requires interpreters so that people actually have actual access to hearings through the use of an interpreter. That lengthens our hearings considerably to make sure that people understand and have an opportunity to fully engage in the hearings that come before the court. The reality is, given our size and scale, while we've had opportunities to come up with some ingenious ways of dealing with the issues that our population brings before the court, it all results in additional judicial time needed. We have 27 standing dockets that we need to cover every day, and then in addition to that, all of the trials that we want to get out. It is like putting a puzzle together every single morning, where we're moving the pieces around to make sure that we will get out every single trial that is ready to go. And that is a task that on some mornings, by the time 10 o'clock is reached and we've moved things around and moved judges around, it is, knock on a lot of wood, something that we've been able to accomplish, but it is not easy. And sometimes, unfortunately, we're not always successful in terms of some of the smaller cases that we're then not able to get out. So I think that we could easily use one more judicial position for our court, given our size, the complexity of our docketing, the vulnerable populations that we are a draw for. We have, as you probably read, we have gang issues that result in the court being involved, and we are trying to come up with ways of dealing with those issues that will lend to better results for the defendants, better results for our community. We are appreciative of the efforts that were done by the legislature to give us the justice reinvestment funding. We have, I think, have a great program. I'd love to talk to more of you about that at any time, where we are really trying to get better results, reduce the reliance on prison, keep people safely in the community. So I thank you for your for giving us this opportunity to explain why we need another judge. We do everything we can to be as efficient and timely as we can, but sometimes it is a struggle.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Thompson, and I am the immediate past presiding judge in Washington County. I'm here on behalf of our current presiding judge, Charlie Bailey, who is unavailable today. And I would note that part of the reason it's such a privilege to be here is that I had the opportunity to speak with many of you along the way, and also with our county commissioners about the need that Washington County has for another judge. I want to just note, I know that you have the comments that I submitted in the supportive letter that was given to the committee from our sheriff. I met with the commissioners and the sheriff yesterday, and also our elected district attorney, Bob Herman, at the annual jail inspection tour. And I know that our county commissioners are very supportive of Washington County having an additional judge. They have actually planned in advance for this by starting the work on a new courtroom within our existing facility, so that we will immediately have the space for a new judge to begin to help us with our dockets. Like my colleagues in Marion County and in Multnomah County, we have tried many different ways to be efficient, respectful of the needs of litigants in the way that we manage our dockets. We have essentially a centralized docketing system for criminal and civil cases. Other than murder cases and complex, very large complex civil cases such as construction defect cases, cases are centrally assigned out by the presiding judge. And then we have individual dockets for family law cases. We have a dedicated judge and referee in our juvenile department so that those most sensitive cases see the same judicial officer with few exceptions. We also have a judge who serves in our arraignment court. We have early case resolution for the most straightforward of the criminal kinds of cases, so that a person can appear at their first appearance at arraignment, receive an offer on their case, and make a decision to resolve their case immediately. That saves time and money for our system. It gives a person the best possibility to immediately engage in probationary services, have a disposition that they can understand. Better for the defendant, better for crime victims. And we have a number of other early resolution type programs and diversion programs, including a deferred early case resolution program for low-level criminal cases. I've mentioned most of these things in my comments here, but I want to highlight those again because I want to let you know that we are working as hard as we can with the resources that we have and as creatively as we can with those resources. And despite that, and having gone through a reengineering process with the National Center for State Courts over the last 18 months or so, we still find ourselves falling behind and having difficulties. I have moved from presiding judge to a trial docket position where I'm hearing family law cases and criminal cases. And now these past couple of days, I'm covering for my colleague, Judge Bailey. So in the world that a trial judge in Washington County, and I imagine the trial judges in Marion County and Multnomah County face during the past couple of days, I have considered assigning out cases when I don't have a judge. I have managed four different emergency custody requests, managed many different other things, did a criminal trial sentencing and a violation of release agreement. These are all things that are mixed into a busy day of a typical trial court judge, and a typical trial court judge may be asked to fill in as a presiding judge as well. So I sit here with that experience. Like my colleague, Judge Waller, and I think Judge Rhodes, we've all heard juvenile cases. We know that those are those cases where the very most vulnerable persons in our community appear and need our time and attention. We try and give the resources in that way. We are falling behind in Washington County. We have needed another judge for a long period of time. I mentioned we could easily accommodate in our docket four more judges, but we are realistic. One more judge will make an enormous difference in the mission that we serve in our community. We have increased by 80,000 in population, roughly, in Washington County since we had a new judicial officer added. So we very much support and hope that this committee will support our request for another judge.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Thompson, a question for you, if I may. And I mean this respectfully, of course. First of all, I completely support this proposal. I think Washington County in particular could use actually at least one more judge. But I'm wondering if there's anything else we can do, either this legislature or the court itself can do. Those of us who are civil practitioners, this has never happened to me, but it's a fairly notorious event that when you have a civil trial in Washington County of anything more than a day, that you go out there and then get bounced the morning of because there's not a judge available. It's really a big problem, and especially for a business center in our state. It's not good business practice. Is there anything we can do? Because very often out-of-state experts are already on the plane at that point, the morning of. Even if it could be, even if civil practitioners could get, say, 3 days' notice, it would really, I think, mm-hmm. go a long way. What can we do, if anything, to help you get there?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, during the 4 years that I served as presiding judge, I made every effort to make sure that we sent out civil cases when they were ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I routinely set out at least one case a week, which was often the only case that was truly ready to go. We increased the number of cases that we tried each week. Or that we tried each year on our civil docket. And so we were aware of that, and we've tried to do those kinds of things. But quite honestly, without an additional judge, we can't sort of send it nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
We had some success in those areas. It's difficult for me to know what we can do beyond having the resource. I would say respectfully that one of the things that has happened in our in the laws is that we have many things that are time sensitive that a judge does not have the option of not hearing. For example, a request for temporary emergency custody mm-hmm. of a child, or a 5-day hearing on a Family Abuse Protection Act order. So those things make our dockets very full, and we have recently started a large bench bar committee with our chief civil judge to try and work on that issue. I know that what you were asking is absolutely true, and it's hard for me to think of an idea at this point other than the additional resource for us that would be most helpful.
Thank you.
So, thank
follow
you.
Up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
A comment, really. Appreciate this proposal. This is certainly long overdue. There are a lot of other counties that have this resource in addition to this three. We are not solving the problem today by passing this bill. Deschutes, Lynn, there are some others, never mind my home turf in Clackamas. And also, as Washington County and other counties work through this in bench bar committees, you guys are not alone. We are here to help, and if we can, just let us know, please.
Okay. And Chair Barker, if I may.
Please.
We have the experience not only in the civil litigation that Representative Barton mentioned, but also in the family law litigation, where experienced attorneys hire reference judges, which may be senior judges, retired judges, or well-qualified pro tem judge practitioners. They hire those folks at great expense, and they do it routinely because they tell us that they cannot get it several days consecutive in our county for a trial. And I would tell you that we work very hard to try and get as many days possible for folks, but without the resource, we are not able to do so.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It can be for any one of you three. I'm curious, and actually, I guess, Judge Rhodes, you were talking a little bit about the judicial settlement. And what I'm Judge Waller, you can jump in there too on this. But for the mediation part of that, what's the success rate? Because the way you were describing, I could really see the benefit of most definitely traveling that path to prevent going into court.
Well, as an example, the case I did yesterday was a case of an attempted murder, several counts against three gang members. They could have been, I'm not confident they could all have been tried at the same time. Each one of those might have been a 2 to 5 day case. If all three could have been tried together, it would have been a 5 day case. I spent the whole day, ended up with pleas at the end of the day, couldn't get to the sentencing. Sentencing is going to take all morning tomorrow. In that case, I met with the individual defendants and their lawyers. I met separately with the district attorney, and we ended up working out a resolution, and all three of them will spend a significant period of time in prison because they're all ballot measure 11 offenses. My Monday case was a divorce where they're fighting over the custody of the child, and that when you go to trial on those, that's when they have to bring out all the heat and the passion, and usually they're throwing mud at each other. And they're the ones who have to co-parent that child for the rest of the child's, well, hopefully for the rest of the parents' lives. And being able to resolve that short of going into trial, either on a temporary hearing or a final hearing, I think really helps those folks, because the resolution that they reach works better for them than a superimposed resolution by a judge. And plus, they haven't had to go on record and say hateful things. I have great success in especially the domestic relations cases, but also I have good success in the criminal arena as well. We have judges who do hosted civil cases, civil settlements, but a lot of those folks also, we have mandatory arbitration on cases that are $50,000 or less. Those cases, I got some statistics, I think in 2014, the about 320 went to arbitration, a little over 18% appealed. So 70 cases came back to the court from arbitration. Those are the smaller cases. Those are not mediation. They're, you know, with a judicial type of a resolution. But typically, they don't have to call experts. When you get into court, a lot of you probably know this, on civil cases, they're going to have to call experts, and the cost of experts is what drives the cost of litigation, and it really drives a lot of people away from the courthouse because they just can't afford the experts. I think that our settlement conferences probably don't rival the number of mediations that are happening out there that we don't even see because they're not part of the court-annexed mediation. I don't want to be disingenuous. My husband is a retired judge who makes his living as a mediator. So some mediators have great success. I know that. But I know that I can't give you a percentage. I can tell you that of the criminal settlement conferences it's probably 3/4 of the ones that I do. Keep in mind that the people who both agree, because that's the only way we do them, is if it's voluntary. If both people agree that they want to try to reach this resolution, that means they've already taken a giant step toward that goal. The ones who don't want to participate are the ones that you're going to end up going to trial.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, is part of our we do a lot of settlement conferences, but all civil cases, family law, we've used the bar to help us out with settlement conferences and family law. As part of our 3194 Justice Reinvestment, every case that opts into Justice Reinvestment or doesn't opt out that is eligible has a judicial settlement conference after a risk assessment assessment is done. That has been, again, very successful, the use of judicial settlement conferences in that fashion in informing both the bench and the district attorney and defense lawyers about really what the risks and needs of this person are and how properly to sort that population into those who really need to be in prison, those who can be safely kept on probation. And so far, our data is looking very good as a result of that settlement conference process.
Excellent.
If you might just say one more comment about the family, the marriage, when those go to pieces. So when you do have those trials and those hateful things are said, that's all public record as well. And I can remember a case where things were said that may or may not have been true, and then suddenly a neighbor who didn't like one of those parties printed a summary and started posting it on trees and telephone poles in the neighborhood of the person, which was, yeah. So anyway, it's I think we all realize that you really desperately need some more help in these courts, and we really appreciate all the work you're doing with the little you have. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2337. We'll open a work session.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2337 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2337 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and then it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
We did the appeals court panel, we put the operative date into the next biennium so there's no physical impact, and being the judges aren't going to be, according to this, be January 17th before they take their position. I'm kind of surprised that it wasn't done that way to avoid ways and means. Good bill, should pass.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2338.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2338 also comes to us at the request of the Judicial Department. It has no revenue impact. We do have a fiscal statement issued, and this also has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We have no amendments before us today. So just to tell you a couple excerpts from the Chief Justice's recommended budget, in 2008, the Public Officials Compensation Commission recommended increasing judicial compensation in order to attract and retain a diversified and experienced bench, and also to ensure that compensation is in line with the responsibility elected judges carry. So now, as of January 2014, Judicial Salary Survey conducted by the National Center for State Courts ranked Oregon judges as followed, and this is adjusted for 2015 increases. The Oregon Supreme Court, they rank 44th out of 51 jurisdictions, which includes the District of Columbia. The Oregon Court of Appeals is ranked 32nd out of 39 jurisdictions, and as many will know, that is one of the consistently most busy intermediate courts in the country. Circuit courts ranked 41st out of 51 jurisdictions. House Bill 2338 increases annual judicial salaries for judges for the Oregon Supreme Court, the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Oregon Tax Court, and Oregon Circuit Courts.
Thank you. Call Chief Justice Ballmer, Chief Marshall, and Kevin Campbell, please.
Thank you again, Chair Barker. For the record, I'm Tom Ballmer, Chief Justice, and we're literally asking for your help in building our bench. As the head of the judicial branch, I look to the future and I think about how are we going to be able to continue to attract the diverse group of highly qualified and successful lawyers to the bench that Oregon has had coming to be judges since 1859. One of the keys to doing that is providing sufficient compensation to attract experienced lawyers, especially those with backgrounds in civil and family law, to judicial careers. Now, experienced and qualified lawyers in criminal cases already are used to public sector salaries and the trade-offs that come with them. But frankly, these days, it is a pay cut for many senior deputy district attorneys to come be a trial judge. And the kinds of deputy district attorneys who are putting their names in are the people with 5 or 8 years of experience, not the people with 15 years of experience. But attorneys with trial experience in some of our most complex cases, difficult family law matters and civil litigation, generally come from the private bar. And while they are attracted by the prestige of the office and the call of public service, as you are, we often find that they can't make the financial portion of the package work for them, especially if they have families or kids in college. Let me just give you two examples. Our former governor appointed someone to the Washington County bench, Hispanic lawyer, experienced with civil practice, fluent in Spanish, and he said he would accept the position until he found out what the salary was, and consulted with his wife and decided that they just could not make that decision as a family. One other example, we have a very experienced and highly qualified judge in Eastern Oregon who would like to retire, has some health problems. She's looking to try and recruit someone to put his name in, either for a governor's appointment or to run for office. There are not very many lawyers out there. Here's someone who is at a good local law firm, experienced civil practitioner. She can't get him to do it because of the pay cut he'd have to take. The people that look like they'd be interested if she stepped down are the younger people in the district attorney's office or the younger public defenders. That's what we're facing. Oregon judges are underpaid by almost any standard, including the 2008 recommendation by the Public Officials Compensation Commission, as the committee administrator said, and by looking at national comparisons or what is paid to other experienced lawyers, not necessarily private sector lawyers, but public sector lawyers, whether they're in the Attorney General's office, in district attorney's offices, in county commissions, or elsewhere. The OJD budget hearings start next week, and I have requested a policy option package to pay judges at the POCC level that was recommended in 2008, which was the last time there was an outside group doing a thoughtful survey of compensation levels in Oregon, adjusted for inflation since 2008. I'm also a co-sponsor of Senate Bill 446, which would allow me to grant judges an annual cost of living increase. The fact is, Oregon needs a better mechanism for ongoing adjustments to judicial salaries, but in the meantime, I ask your support for both of those bills in order to maintain a judiciary that lives up to public expectations of fairness, protecting people's rights, and providing justice completely and without delay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ballmer and Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Chris Marshall, and I'm the president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. We have a couple other members of our executive committee here today, Mary James from Marion County and Jody Mooney from Lane County, and our other two members, Paula Brownhill from Clatsop County and Janet Stauffer from Wasco County, couldn't be with us today. But we thank you for the opportunity to address you here today. We've provided some written materials for you, and I know we've met with a number of you, so I'm not going to go into a lot of the details from those materials other than to follow up with a little bit of what the Chief Justice said. Part of our job is to make sure that the judges around our state represent the excellence of the Oregon State Bar. We want people who are going to be able to handle the complex matters that come before the court for the civil matters, the criminal matters, and for our important family law matters. And we are reaching a point where it used to be that people from the civil area would have to take a huge pay cut. I was one of those who came to the bench and did that, and I made that choice because I wanted to serve the public. But we are now at a level where even people who are doing public service jobs and at government positions have to take big pay cuts to come and be a circuit court judge. And we reach a point where when we now go as representatives of our Judges Association to our three law schools and address the students there, and you get a lot of these young, eager people, and they're excited about their careers, and they ask you, how do you become a judge? What can I do to become a judge? What suggestions do you have? I want to be able to tell them, first of all, network in Oregon, go to school in Oregon, and stay in Oregon, and be an excellent judge in Oregon. It is becoming harder and harder for me to answer, so I avoid that. Because if you go anywhere else in the country, they could do better almost now. I think I heard the number 41, but we've actually had some adjustments on the figures, and we actually fall now more toward the bottom. So we're asking for the legislature to just recognize the importance of the position of the judges, the circuit court judges, the appellate judges, and so that we can continue to attract people that are going to be able to perform the important services there. And the reality is that the compensation piece is part of what drives people's decision making and whether they can fill those positions or not. It's an unfortunate reality, but that is the case. And so we're just asking that we be set at a level that would not even push us into the top half of the country. We just want to not be on the bottom and be able to not have to turn away people that would otherwise be excellent judges here in Oregon.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, it's my name is Kevin Campbell. It's my privilege to represent the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. Just a couple minor things to add at this point. The first is I'd like to thank this committee, because as we've been trying to achieve this 2008 Public Officials Compensation Commission report recommendation over the last several years, in 2013, this committee heard a similar bill, supported it, and I know a number of the members who are on this committee still today were a part of encouraging the Ways and Means members to help us take steps in 2013. So I begin with just saying thank you. The second is I get a chance to work with Judge Marshall and the four other members of the executive committee of this association, and they have kind of the uncomfortable responsibility on behalf of the other judges in the state to carry this message to you. And I can tell you up front, it's uncomfortable for folks like Judge Marshall to get in front of you and ask for a compensation increase. But they do it because they understand the more far-reaching implications of not reaching a level where we can continue to attract the kind of highly qualified judges that this state requires. As you already heard in some of the testimony previously today, you can already understand how complex the work that judges do today, and that it's not just they're not just ruling, they're problem solving, they're working with families, they're working with complex business cases. And so the level of competence required is increasing, and it's extremely important. And I know a theme for this committee is how important public confidence is in our justice system. This is a piece of that, and so I want to thank you for this time. I want to thank the Chief Justice for his leadership on this whole issue, and I encourage the committee to send this to Ways and Means with an enthusiastic due pass. And then I also would ask you if you would also just take time to encourage your counterparts on Ways and Means to look favorably on this. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair Barker and members of the committee.
Representative Krueger. You mentioned that, I guess as Judge Marshall would be kind of uncomfortable coming before us. Probably we would be more uncomfortable coming before him. And you know, the members of this committee in the past have been stalwarts, yes, of supporting the judges and the realization that highly intelligent, qualified, dedicated young men and women, and most of the time they're not young by my standards. You know, they're in their, what, 50s, a lot of them? To get those people to leave a practice and they got children in college, still paying for their house or their Mercedes-Benz, whatever it is. In fact, if we want those type of people, there has to be incentives there. At the same time, realize that I've been here 15 years at $1,804 a month, and I probably not worth any more than that. But in reality, you know, we had Representative Garrett go over to the court, bright young guy, got a pretty smart one sitting next to me. Someday he'll maybe go over there. But in
no offense.
You may change your mind when you mature. But, you know, I've worked with this judge some, Paul Dominguez before, and they've always been accommodating to the legislators' needs. And we much appreciate that. That relationship wasn't always there. And we want to continue, at least I want to continue to build that relationship and make the public understand the role of the courts and how they serve the public. But the public doesn't think about it. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair
Barker. Yep. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to say, I have been sitting here, Justice Ballmer, here. I was taught by my folks certain levels of respect, and you're like, way up here, and the fact that you're sitting in front of me,
yeah,
having to talk about this, I'm so humbled. I don't know. I'm gonna cry. And I've been sitting here listening to this. I mean, you're coming to me asking for a salary increase, me, of all people. And I just have the utmost respect for you guys. I don't even know why I'm saying this. It just means a lot to me. And so I'll do whatever I have to do. With some ankles and arms and stuff, but I just want to thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps this question is best directed to Judge Marshall, but anyone could weigh in. In your testimony and the Chief's testimony, you talked a lot about the difficulty of attracting judges, which is obviously true. It seems to me that another side to this that I think we are seeing more of, but I wanted to get your take on this, is that is judges kind of in their prime when they've been fully trained, leaving the bench and causing a lot of disruption in personnel, et cetera. And is it just me? It just feels to me anecdotally that we're seeing more of that lately. What's your take?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that question. That is something that we didn't touch on. In addition to not being able to bring on the newer people, sometimes that would be highly qualified, we have had a number of people leave earlier than they would have if the economic situation was different. There's a whole, I think you talked about mediation here earlier. That is the business now for judges who leave the bench. And it started in California really years ago, and now it's migrated elsewhere, and we're starting to see it in Oregon. If you open up the Oregon State Bar Bulletin, there it is. And these are not necessarily people who were ready for retirement. We've had a few recently in our county who left who otherwise would have stayed. But and I've had people, I do a lot of settlement conferences, and I've had some of the civil lawyers ask me, why are you here? Why are you doing this at the courthouse instead of doing it in the private sector? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. but you raise a very good point. We lose people at the incoming, and we lose them when they should be in the prime of their judicial career.
Thank you.
Well, I think this is really important, and I absolutely support it. But I want to echo what I think Representative Krieger said, which is that as much as it's absolutely important for us to address judicial compensation, we want good people to want these jobs and stay in these jobs, and you know, bless you for your great work. I think we have to acknowledge that there are a whole bunch of other elected positions, the compensation for which this body probably has a role in weighing in, that are that haven't changed much either and are at least as out of whack with other opportunities as judges' compensation. And we just can't create a situation where the only people who can be involved with elected service in our state are people who have a spouse who makes a lot of money, or you know, parents or grandparents who made a lot of money. And I think we're trending dangerously in that direction, and if we really want to be representative of our communities, we have to address it. So I hope that we will, with the same enthusiasm and vigor that we are supporting this issue now, we'll have the courage to turn to some of those other issues, because it matters a lot for a representative democracy. Not us.
No, and you.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for all you do. Yeah. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2338.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2338 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2338 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But one brief note. I said this to Mr. Campbell off the record before. I have sponsored a virtually identical bill. I believe it's relating to judiciary, being that this is the vehicle that's moving forward. There's a relating to clause relating to judiciary, and to the extent the department or any of my colleagues want to do something constructive with the judiciary, that relating clause is open.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion passes. The bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2425.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2425 comes to us at the request of the Office of the Governor on behalf of the Department of Corrections. We have all the paperwork on this. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact. We have no amendments before us today. So under current Oregon law, the Department of Corrections staff are only allowed to access juvenile records of those offenders who are serving their DOC sentence in the physical custody of Oregon Youth Authority. This can be problematic, it said, as juvenile records are considered essential in order to adequately provide care for adult offenders who have previous juvenile records. House Bill 2425 provides Oregon Youth Authority and Juvenile Department directors the authority to grant DOC access to juvenile records of offenders who are in or entering into DOC custody on an adult conviction. House Bill 2425 also mandates that Oregon Youth Authority adopt rules to carry out its purpose.
Okay, thank you. Kim Brockham, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Kim Brockamp. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2425 and answer any questions you have. As you heard, this bill would give the Department of Corrections access to juvenile records, which we don't currently have. Our goal would be to accomplish this through rulemaking with Oregon Youth Authority and potentially input from community corrections juvenile directors, as they're a very important stakeholder to us in this process. Just so you know, these records would be used for all types of safety and security issues for staff and for the adults in our custody, issues around classification, housing, work assignments, programming, sex offender evaluations upon release, credit for time served, risk of self-harm, and transition and reentry planning. A current example. Right now, adjudicated youth is in custody at Oregon Youth Authority. They're over the age of 18, and they commit a staff assault. So when they commit the staff assault, they can be charged as an adult and come to the Department of Corrections custody. We can have access to the information about that adult conviction, but we don't have any access to those records around their behavior, their treatment, their programming, basic kind of case management principles we would need during their time as an adjudicated youth at the Oregon Youth Authority, and potentially in community supervision with the juvenile community corrections. So for these reasons, for case management, for safety, for release planning, the Department of Corrections would ask that you would move this bill and you would approve this bill with a due pass recommendation. So I'm available to answer any questions that you might have regarding this bill.
Are there any questions for anybody? Thank you very much. Mark McKinney, I'm sorry, McKechnie, Tori Lynn and Gail Meyer, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We represent approximately 1,000 children and youth at any given time in Multnomah County who are involved in the juvenile court system, involving children in foster care and youth in the juvenile justice system. Probably about 20% at any given time are involved in the juvenile justice system. I think more importantly, for this hearing, we've been extensively involved in public policy related to the Oregon Juvenile Code, and in particular the confidentiality of juvenile records in the Juvenile Code, including participating on an Oregon Law Commission work group that's been working for about 3 years on this very issue. We understand that the Department of Corrections does have legitimate interests to access some juvenile records under some circumstances, but we are concerned that the drafting of this bill is far too broad and that the access it grants outweighs the potential value of some of the records that could be obtained under this language. We're talking about amending ORS 419A257, which starts out explaining the importance to keep these very sensitive records confidential. The records concerning children, which is the term the juvenile code uses for a minor who's been a victim or alleged to be a victim of abuse or neglect, a ward who's under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court for an abuse or neglect petition, a youth, meaning a young person who's been charged of an offense that could be a crime, and a youth offender, meaning somebody, a minor, who's been adjudicated of that offense. So we're talking about records that could go back to birth, when a child, if a child became involved in the juvenile court system as a victim of abuse or neglect, often drug exposure in those cases, and everything through age 25 for a youth who is under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and the Oregon Youth Authority. So this has a very broad scope and includes some of the most sensitive records that would be in a county or the Oregon Youth Authority's possession about that young person. And we think that there needs to be some narrowing of the provisions in this bill so that it is specific to legitimate interests that DOC has for safety and treatment and doesn't sweep in a person's entire young life and all of the traumas that they experienced and everything that they did that may have come to the attention of law enforcement and the courts. The exceptions that are currently in the statute specifically apply to parties in a case and service providers who are involved contemporaneously with the juvenile court case or are handing off services to the youth, one to the other. This statute would allow access to juvenile records years later after the juvenile court involvement ended, and we think it would be useful to narrow it in a couple of different ways. One, to make it clear that access does not apply to child welfare records regarding abuse and neglect that might come into the possession of the county juvenile department or the Oregon Youth Authority. And two, that the time frame for accessing these records be narrowed either to the kind of circumstance that was given as an example where the person is transferring either because of a new crime charged as an adult or a transfer because of a Measure 11 sentence that exceeds the age 25. There's a direct handoff and transfer of the person from the Youth Authority to the Department of Corrections. Absolutely, it makes sense to share information at that juncture. And as well, there might be a gap between juvenile court involvement and DOC involvement in other cases, it seems like there needs to be some kind of time constraint, say 2 to 3 years in between, no more than 2 to 3 years in between when the person was involved in the juvenile system and when the person is involved in the DOC. Beyond that, I fail to understand what the value of the information could be relative to the risk of harm to the person if that information is disclosed and could be handled inappropriately once it's released to another agency. So I'm glad to answer any questions.
So I would just off the top of my head, I haven't really looked into this. So the person's in sent OY because they're an arsonist, which may be some problem. Then they turn 18 or 19, they assault somebody, so we're coming over with assault. You wouldn't want the DOC to have the information about an arson, or would that be okay?
Chair Barker, that's an excellent question, and another piece which I failed to mention is that the history of offense of a juvenile is already accessible to the Department of Corrections, and I'm told that through JGIS, easier access could be granted through intergovernmental or interagency agreement to give them direct access to the offense history in JGIS, which would address that. And I think secondarily, I think, again, having a time frame so that if more information were needed, DOC could request it, but we're not talking about going back 10, 20 years potentially in someone's life and obtaining records that are that old.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Many of our members do represent juveniles, both in juvenile dependency and juvenile delinquency proceedings. We also would like to register caution in going forward with the bill as it's currently written, and we hope that it can get some more narrow sideboards. I'm mindful that the Oregon Law Commission took a very comprehensive, lengthy work study on access to juvenile records. And it's always a problem when you do one of those big, comprehensive, global things with all stakeholders there, and then to come in with a little bill.
that adjusts all that. It's a best practice to keep juvenile records confidential because they're induced with the notion that these are for the best interests of the child, and then to have them transferred over to the Department of Correction, which operates by a different standard. There's a delicacy there. We would also urge caution. We don't necessarily think that the paradigm used in the bill here of relying on rules is the best way to go. We do submit that legislatively there ought to be sideboards on this so that everybody knows what's in and what's out, and so that this can be done in a very conscious design with a bigger picture.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Barker, thank you. My name is Tori Lynn. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Lynn County. I'm also the legislative chair for the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association. Thank you for the opportunity that we have to testify on this bill. Oregon statute is pretty strict and pretty clear around juvenile records, around maintenance, disclosure, providing transcripts, exceptions, and confidentiality. County juvenile departments, as the keepers of those records, are guided by ORS statutes. And we recognize that the Department of Correction does have a business need for information related to juveniles that are coming into their system. We support those records being transferred for youth who are in OYA custody, being transferred to DOC either via a Measure 11, so their sentences and their age, they've aged out of OYA and then being transferred to DOC, or the example that you gave, Chair Barker, around a youth maybe getting a charge while in OYA custody and then being transferred to the DOC. The population, I think, concerning for juvenile directors is that juvenile population, and I think the comments that you've heard, you know, I think we voiced some of those same concerns around, you know, it's very general, it's very broad at this point. We have had ongoing conversations with Department of Corrections, made some recommendations around the rulemaking process and having there's a Juvenile Justice Information Steering Committee, the JGIS Steering Committee, that kind of makes the policies and rules around the use of JGIS, and having that group be involved in the rulemaking. There's several juvenile directors that sit on that committee, as well as folks that are very familiar with the confidentiality laws around juvenile records and then just the system operationally. So we would suggest some maybe amendments that would include that committee. And just around the rulemaking authority granted to OYA, maybe, you know, some disconnect there for juvenile departments around, you know, when I get a request for records in my county, I discuss that with my county attorney and they interpret the statute and we make a decision around whether we're not going to release those records. So I don't know if just the rulemaking authority would clear that up. I think statutorily, you know, there may need to be some changes as each county is going to do that same process with their county attorneys as they look at things. We would also suggest some type of age range. And you heard 2 or 3 years mentioned earlier in testimony. We would suggest maybe kids, you know, being used from, you know, 15 to 28 age range. 15 because an adult conviction could happen at 18, and that would give a 3-year span there for DOC to be able to look at some history. And then 28 because OYA commitment time ends at 25, and so again, you have a kind of a 3-year window there. We do believe that, you know, there's good reasons for DOC to have access to some juvenile records. I think, again, it's kind of determining really what the parameters are around that, and concerns around making sure that the information is relevant. We talk a lot right now about using the developmental approach in working with juveniles, and that, you know, decisions that someone makes at 12 years old are going to be much different at, you know, 25. And so is that a relevant piece of information for DOC to be using in their treatment of that person now that's an adult? So, again, I think those concerns have been voiced in the previous testimony. So we would, again, welcome further conversation. Directors would welcome further conversation around how we can make this work. We think it is relevant, and there are some things that we would like to help out to do.
And I'm assuming that DLC doesn't want to take in things that aren't relevant. So I would ask that you get together. I won't move the bill today. I'd ask that you get together with DLC and see if you can't work out. I mean, it seems like there will be some easy, not maybe not easy. There will be some kind of compromise that can be reached. I do want to ensure the safety of people going into the prison and the prison staff.
Absolutely.
I'm concerned about that. So I don't want something they should know about not being known, and I'm sure you don't either. So if you could meet with them, I would really appreciate it and get some amendments and get back to us so we get this thing rolled out.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Can I ask a question? Did I hear correctly, if a juvenile was in treatment under OYI and they moved in at 25 and entered in treatment in prison, would that treatment data be available to them under current statute? Is that?
I don't know.
I think I heard you say, but I wasn't sure.
I don't know that we said that. I think.
I thought there were certain circumstances where the data could be passed now.
I think what he said, I asked if the person had an arson conviction at 17 and then made an assault at 19 and was being sent over because of the assault, could they know about the arson? And I believe you said that if it was a...
No, I understand that, because I was talking about the specific question of therapy for the person's best interest. I mean, for the...
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, I'll give you the best answer that I can, and someone else may need to correct me in the future. But looking at the statute that's being amended, it creates specific exceptions for who the Oregon Youth Authority and the Juvenile Department can share these records with, and it has to do with history and prognosis, so the sensitive treatment records. And the Department of Corrections is not on that list, and so they are amending, adding a section to allow them access as well. So I do believe they are prohibited from getting that easily. I think the other remedy on it, which is not efficient overall but can be done on a case-by-case basis, obviously, is for the subject of the records to sign a release of information.
That's true. Yeah. I was just thinking, as you think about changes, making sure the transfer of information that was for the person's best interest be some option. And yeah, maybe it's simply signing a waiver. Maybe that's the answer.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Thank you very much. Appreciate your input on that, and hopefully we get something resolved. Any further business come before the committee? We stand adjourned. Before the committee, we stand adjourned. Any further business come